It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the federal government shutdown continues, lawmakers are split over extending subsidies for Affordable Care Act marketplaces.
Democratic lawmakers say it's a priority to pass subsidies in addition to funding the government. Republicans, for the most part, argue for funding the government now and negotiating subsidies later this year.
The clock is ticking as people are signing up for employer plans now, in some cases, and the enrollment period for Affordable Care Act marketplace coverage starts November 1st.
Nathan Hodek is the Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner. Commissioner Hodek, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Yes, thank you. Good morning.
The Affordable Care Act marketplace coverage at the center of this shutdown. Has uncertainty over subsidies affected the kind of plans insurers are providing or saying they're going to provide next year here in Wisconsin?
Unfortunately, it has. We're very concerned about what the not extending the enhanced premium subsidies is going to do for our ACA market as we go into 2026. We've been very fortunate in Wisconsin the last few years to have a strong and stable health insurance market. In the Affordable Care Act marketplace, we actually hit our highest enrollment in the current year. We have a little over 313,000 Wisconsin residents enrolled in that market. And we're very concerned that without the enhanced premium subsidies being extended, we're going to see tens of thousands of people potentially lose that coverage. And so that's very concerning as we're about to enter the open enrollment period for next year. And that's why it's really important as Congress is continuing this debate that they continue the enhanced subsidies to make sure that we keep our market strong and stable and people don't lose their coverage.
Let's talk about timing. November 1st, as we mentioned, that's when the enrollment period for marketplace coverage starts. Is it significant to you? How important is it that this subsidy issue gets resolved one way or another by then?
I mean, the sooner the better. Frankly, this should have been resolved months ago. Insurance commissioners, my colleagues from across the country have sent, I think, four different letters collectively to Congress, going back to earlier this year, explaining the importance of making sure that these enhanced premium subsidies are extended. And the longer this drags out, the more negative impact it's going to have on people's ability to get coverage. So, you know, we can still make it work for next year's coverage period. But the longer this drags out, the more challenging it's going to be for people to get the coverage they need for next year.
The enhanced subsidies were passed under a COVID-related piece of legislation, right? This is kind of an emergency to help people out during a tough time. Is there a case to be made to say, hey, that emergency is over, we can be done with those subsidies and let things shake out the way the Affordable Care Act was originally intended?
Well, the reality is we continue to see healthcare costs overall increase. And as a result, we see health insurance costs increase because health insurance reflects the underlying cost of healthcare overall. And so keeping the subsidies in place is really important to make sure that people can afford healthcare coverage as we're seeing these costs increase.
If this extension fails to pass before the subsidies expire in December, you mentioned you see a significant number of people losing coverage or not being able to afford that marketplace coverage. What about downgrading options? The Trump administration at some points has said, hey, maybe you go to a lower level of coverage, a catastrophic care type of level of coverage. Will those options be a significant difference if these subsidies don't pass?
You know, one of the important things to remember about the Affordable Care Act marketplace is that there are certain guaranteed healthcare coverage aspects. You know that if you're getting an ACA market health plan, you'll be able to get access to maternity care and to visit your doctor and different care that you need. The concern is that with some of these other non-ACA compliant plans, that you don't get that level of coverage. And on top of that, it can actually cost more for people. So that's really been one of the strengths and one of the benefits of the ACA marketplace is that it's provided a lot of people, like I said, 313,000 people in Wisconsin have coverage through this marketplace. It's provided good, strong healthcare coverage that allows people to get the care they need for themselves and their families. And if they lose that coverage and have to go on lesser coverage with higher deductibles and higher out-of-pocket costs and less benefits, that's very concerning for access to care for people across the state.
Is it a concern, again, if the subsidies don't go through, they aren't maintained, and people start dropping out of marketplace coverage, are you concerned that some insurance providers might withdraw from some markets in the state?
Unfortunately, that's a concern as we already look to next year. Insurance companies are looking at the market dynamics, looking at what makes sense for them from a business practice standpoint, and having to make decisions about what plans they're offering in the marketplace, what service areas they're offering those plans. So there's really a compounding effect here where without the enhanced premium subsidies being extended, not only do we see premium rates increase for people, but we're also likely to see fewer plan options for people. And again, as I mentioned, we've been very fortunate. Over the last few years, we've seen more insurance companies providing more plan options, really in almost every corner of the state. And because of the subsidies being in place, people have been able to find ACA compliant plans, no matter where they live in Wisconsin, at a very affordable rate, in some cases, $0 premium plans. But that's going to change. We're very concerned that that people, regardless of where you live in the state, are going to experience some pretty extreme sticker shock when the open enrollment period begins. And that will lead to people, unfortunately, dropping coverage. And, then when they need care in the future, they won't have the health insurance and the protection of health insurance that will allow them to get the care they need and not put themselves in a position where it can be potentially financially devastating if they don't have the right health insurance.
Affordable Care Act subsidies are at the center of the federal government shutdown. Nathan Hodek is with us, insurance commissioner here in Wisconsin, looking at the impact of these subsidies and their potential disappearance next year, what it all means for Wisconsin. Commissioner Hodek, you mentioned your colleagues, other insurance commissioners around the country, making the case to Congress to extend that. It struck me Republican and Democratic insurance commissioners seem to be on the same page. Are you generally seeing that kind of bipartisan support from your colleagues around the country?
Yes, there is. There's bipartisan concern from my colleagues, other insurance commissioners in states across the country, red states and blue states, because everyone is seeing a negative impact as we look ahead to next year from not extending the enhanced subsidies. In some states, we're seeing premiums be filed for next year that are increasing by as much as 40-50%. I mean, that's going to be some extreme sticker shock for people. And so, insurance commissioners, regardless of, again, red state or blue state, want to make sure that they maintain a stable and strong market where people can access care and an affordable price point. And without the enhanced premium subsidies being in place, there's a real concern that just won't be attainable for a lot of people, regardless if you're in Wisconsin or any other state across the country.
And we're focusing, of course, on the Affordable Care Act marketplace. A lot of changes came through that congressional funding bill earlier this year. Do you have your eye on anything, any other kinds of health insurance? Have there been other shakeups because of the congressional funding bill or this shutdown with other kinds of health coverage?
Well, we know there's going to be a number of changes to Medicaid coming down the road. And we don't deal with the Medicaid program at our department, so I'll defer discussing Medicaid to my colleagues at the Department of Health Services. But one thing I'd like to highlight is there was actually a recent study that just came out from the Urban Institute and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation that showed that without the enhanced premium subsidies being in place, we're expecting uncompensated care costs to increase by $73 million in Wisconsin next year. And what that means is that's not just having a negative impact for people who have enrollment through the ACA market, those costs, that $73 million in additional uncompensated care, gets spread throughout the entire healthcare system. So regardless of what type of healthcare coverage you have, if you get coverage through your employer or any other type of coverage, those costs, those uncompensated care costs, $73 million are going to be spread and paid by everyone across the state who has any type of coverage. And so that's you know, where this isn't just about the 313,000 people who are enrolled in this market. There's real concern about the ripple effect and just the overall impact on the healthcare marketplace as we look not just to next year, but beyond 2026 as well.
Returning to the Affordable Care Act marketplace as we start to wrap up, Commissioner Hodeck, people who are on the marketplace right now are thinking about it. They may be hearing us talk. They may be hearing this news and saying, well, that's not for me, then I'm not going to bother looking. What do you tell people concerned about or curious about ACA marketplace coverage given this uncertainty?
We always tell people to shop around. The open enrollment period is an opportunity to go to healthcare.gov and look for plan options that are right for you and your family. There are a lot of options still out there, even though we might see a reduction from the number of options we have this year. There are still a lot of plan options out there, and there are various price points for people to look at those plan options. So it's important that people maintain health insurance for the financial protection for you and your family. So we encourage people to use the open enrollment period, shop around, and use your voice, reach out to your member of Congress, and encourage them to extend the enhanced premium subsidies so we can make sure the market stays strong and stable.
Commissioner Hodeck, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Nathan Hodeck is the Wisconsin Insurance Commissioner. We've been talking about the federal shutdown and a debate over extending subsidies for Affordable Care Act marketplaces. Have you been using Affordable Care Act marketplace coverage, or are you thinking of doing it next year? What are you seeing? What's that experience been like? What are you worried about as open enrollment comes up on November 1st? Email us, wisconsintoday@wpr.org, to share your story.
Coming up, data centers are popping up around Wisconsin with more in the works. Find out what's driving the building spree.
Something like generative AI uses a lot more computing power, so they need more of these servers, more of these computers set up. And that's why we're seeing such an increase in demand of these data centers.
That's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Data center projects are springing up across Wisconsin with more than 40 in the state already and more potentially on the way.
From the massive Microsoft campus in Mount Pleasant to smaller projects in cities like Eau Claire and Wausau, much of Wisconsin is in close proximity to these developments.
Okay, but what do data centers actually do? And why are companies building them all over Wisconsin and beyond?
We're turning to Wisconsin computer science and engineering experts for a look at the impact these projects have on our technology, on our communities, and on our electrical grid.
Rick Bingen is an assistant professor and chair of the computer science department at Carthage College. Rick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks for having me.
Data centers all over the headlines lately, plans in many communities, proposals, some pushback to them. But what actually happens inside the doors of a data center?
I like to think of a data center as a warehouse for digital goods. You know, they're filled with computers that would otherwise have to be elsewhere, either on the premises of schools or businesses. But they're in these giant buildings where they can all be controlled at the same time.
A phrase I used to hear more and not so much lately, server farms. Is this the descendant of what we used to call server farms?
Yeah, certainly servers are a big part of what's going on inside a data center.
I think as a layperson of a couple different things that might happen here. One is storage of data. So if I upload a cat video to the cloud, it might reside there. but then also processing of data. If I go online and do, say, a search for cat videos, that processing would be a different function. Do both of those things happen in data centers?
Yeah. So those are two big things, storing data and then content delivery, as you said, that video actually being streamed to you, whether it's YouTube or Netflix. But there's also a lot of redundancy, too. So if one of those data centers goes down, another data center will still be able to deliver that information to you.
I wanted to talk about that redundancy. So my cat video might exist in the cloud, which sounds very ethereal, but it's actually on a server in a data center here, but also maybe, what, another 1 to 5 data centers? How much redundancy is there out there?
It really depends on the company. You know, larger companies like Netflix and YouTube, they want their content to be available no matter what. So they're going to have a lot more redundancy to make sure that their content is in multiple places. So just one data center being down isn't going to cause issues. Smaller companies that are doing enterprise IT, they might only have one data center where their information stands. And if that data center goes down, that business will be, not functioning for that period of time until it's back up.
Then there's another thing. We can store our cat videos. We can search for other people's cat videos. Well, now more and more, we can use generative AI programs to make our own cat videos. As I understand it, Rick, that takes a lot more processing power, a lot more room on these servers. How much of a game changer is that when it comes to demand for our data centers?
Yeah, it's definitely increasing the demand quite a bit. I like to think of, I teach some game development courses, and students will find that, you know, a laptop might not be the best for processing and making games compared to, you know, crunching numbers in a spreadsheet. And it's the same at these data centers. Something like generative AI uses a lot more computing power than the average application on your computer. So they need more of these servers, more of these computers set up. And that's why we're seeing such an increase in demand of these data centers being built everywhere.
For, imagine, I guess, an average computer user who's online with some social media and things like that, maybe uses a chat GPT to help with a report at work or something like that. How much are we interacting with data centers without really being aware of it?
I mean, these days, almost everything that you do is going to be touching a data center. Social media, companies like Facebook, TikTok, all of these companies, they're going to either have their own data centers on their premises, or they're building data centers around the country, around the world. You know, we talked about redundancy, but also there's latency. Having a data center closer means that things load faster. So everything you do online is pretty much in these data centers. I used to work for an insurance company, and at a certain point, it doesn't make sense to keep all of your data in an in-house server farm. There's companies that run the cloud, as we've heard, that, you know, they take it upon themselves to make sure the data is secure, make sure that the temperature is right, make sure the humidity is right. So pretty much anything you're doing online is probably housed in a data center somewhere.
We're talking about data center projects in Wisconsin and what they actually do. We have Carthage College computer science professor Rick Bingen with us. As a member of the media, Rick, it seems like these data center stories, these proposals are happening left and right. Is there something about Wisconsin that makes it an attractive place to site data centers?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple different reasons that Wisconsin makes sense. Obviously, we do have Chicago nearby and Milwaukee. And, you know, these are large areas that are going to want content delivery. But on the other hand, a big part of it is obviously the Great Lakes. These data centers need to be cooled down. And it uses a lot more electricity to use something like fans or just air conditioning to keep these computers cool. So the method these days is usually oftentimes water cooling. Places like Arizona don't have nearly as much
ability to have water compared to here near the Great Lakes. They also have the option that, you know, when it's winter and the air maybe gets colder, they can kind of open and bring in cold air into the system to cool down and not use as much electricity by just using what's already here.
We have these data centers going up based on increasing real demand, and I think anticipation that the demand is going to keep going up. I see some counter thoughts out there, Rick, that there's kind of a bubble here that we're overbuilding. The AI that's driving this, it's interesting. A lot of money is going into it, but maybe it's not going to generate the revenue companies think we do. Is there a future in which maybe the bubble bursts and we have a lot of excess data center capacity?
You know, there's always the possibility that we're overbuilding. I think we've seen different bubbles like that in the technology sphere, such as hiring more people in computer science, IT, than was necessary. So there was big layoffs on the West Coast over the last couple of years. But I think everything that's digital can be moved to a data center. So, you know, whether it's a bubble right now, I think maybe it won't be used right away, but eventually those things are going to be used. There's, you know, processing of these things is going to get bigger. And so having the infrastructure there does mean that we'll be ready for that need.
And finally, these data centers, there's jobs that go into building them, of course. How much work actually goes on in that data center when it's up and running that requires a human in the building to do that work?
Yeah, so as you said, there's a lot of jobs for building these. Once the centers are built, there are, you know, they're big buildings, they have a big footprint, but they don't have as many people working inside of them as a similar like office building. So they still have IT needs. People have to be watching that server equipment, as you brought up. Stuff is going to burn out, stuff is going to, you know, have different problems. So there are definitely a number of IT needs of people keeping track and watching these things, making sure the temperature is right, making sure humidity stays right. And then there's engineers that will be needed to make sure that the actual infrastructure is maintained. So unfortunately, these buildings have a much larger footprint than they do job openings once they're up and running. But they are pretty necessary for our current economy and how people use their computers.
Rick, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Rick Bingen is an assistant professor and chair of the computer science department at Carthage College. He's with us to help better understand what data centers do and what they mean for Wisconsin communities. Now we turn to the energy demands of these data centers and what kind of impact they can have on the state's power grid and our electric bills. Lena Rold is a professor of engineering at UW-Madison, where she researches electrical power systems and renewable energy. Lena, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We keep seeing these data centers opening up in Wisconsin of various sizes. Big picture, are these using enough electricity to where it's, you know, affecting our grid, the amount of power we need?
Yes, the new data centers that are being built right now in Wisconsin are really large. So for example, the one that is currently under construction in Mount Pleasant is expected to consume 450 megawatts of power. That is about the same amount as all households in Milwaukee together. So it goes without saying that that's a lot of power.
That's huge. Do we have the energy production, the electricity production to keep up with that kind of demand in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so it's the role of the utilities to make sure that there is sufficient electricity available for new customers when they get interconnected and they get contracts for purchasing that electricity. But it's also the role then of the utilities to think about what potential new infrastructure we might need, like, for example, new power plants or new transmission lines. Generally speaking, in the Midwest, it's not like we have lots and lots of power that is just lying around waiting to be used. So we should expect that we will need new infrastructure and new power generation capacity in order to meet this new demand.
Well, we can't put up a power plant overnight. Are we seeing new construction kicking off on, I don't know what, natural gas plants or wind and solar with these data centers in mind?
Yeah, so the utilities have been signaling that they want to build new gas power plants in the area where these data centers are being built. Also, there is, for example, new renewable energy generation that is under construction. But yeah, the natural gas power plants, not only in Wisconsin, but kind of in many parts of the country, are expected to contribute a lot to meeting this new demand from data centers.
I know a lot of coal power plants have been closed down over the years, the Trump administration giving directives to say, hey, keep them open, even if they're not really financially viable right now. Is this a case we might see older coal plants staying online for longer than expected to keep up with this demand?
Yeah, so the coal power plants that we have in Wisconsin, they have been set to retire and go off the grid. And so already we have seen some of them kind of taking longer to be taken off the grid than was expected. And we can, it's not surprising that utilities might consider keeping coal power plant online longer, because of course their first priority is to make sure that we have electricity when we need it, regardless of what is the source of that electricity. So yeah, I would say that there is a concern that could keep the coal power plants online longer than what had been necessary. So that could change the plants.
We're talking about data center projects in Wisconsin and the energy, the electricity demand they're creating. UW-Madison engineering professor Lena Rold is with us. Lena, any business that we open up is going to need electricity. Probably if I left here and opened a chain of, I don't know, convenience stores, there'd be some electricity demand. It seems like data centers are something special. What is it about them that uses so much electricity?
Yeah, so inside a data center, there's a lot of computers. And you might notice that when you're starting your computer, if you run it really hard, you get that fan to go on and it is making noise to cool the computer. And you can see the battery drain if it's your laptop. And so essentially, a data center is just a big collection of computers that are working together and to solve certain computing tasks. So particularly the GPUs that are often used in artificial intelligence and AI training and AI inference, they are very power hungry. They need a lot of power, each and every one of them. And a data center can have tens and thousands of such GPUs together. So when you are running that data center, you need a lot of power just to keep the GPUs doing this, for example, the AI inference, which is what happens when we are asking, for example, ChatGPT something. So the scale of energy consumption for a data center is quite different from a convenience store. And that is also what is new now. Because of course we've had data centers around for a long time. There's many data centers that are spread throughout Wisconsin and the country. But what is new now with these new data centers that are specialized for AI is that they are much, much bigger, both in size and also power consumption than other data centers. So that has really changed how much power we need for computing. And so we are seeing projections that data center power consumption that has been fairly constant around 2-3% in the last 10, 15 years is now projected to increase to possibly as much as 12% by 2030.
Now, part of the story is running those computers, but also keeping them cool enough, right? They're pretty sensitive to temperature fluctuations. I know already air conditioning season, high heat days can be big peak electricity use days. Is this just going to magnify that? Is it going to take much more energy to keep these data centers cool on, I don't know, a 95 degree day, and that's going to add to our peak demand?
That is a really good question. So cooling in these newer data centers typically rely on liquid cooling. So it uses water rather than air. It's much more efficient than what has been in typically older data centers. With this cooling that, for example, the data center in Mount Pleasant is expected to use water cooling and closed loop water cooling, which is good because it both reduces energy consumption and it reduces water consumption. There would likely be a difference in how much it consumes on a hot day versus a cold day, but it would be less significant possibly than if it was, for example, using air cooling. That being said, just adding a lot of power consumption to the grid, and particularly data centers are expected to sort of be consuming power quite sort of constantly. And so adding hundreds of megawatts of power to the grid and assuming that they will also be consuming on those hot summer days, that could really, you know, strain the grid much more than it where it is today. And so already in recent years, we have seen reports from the North American Electric Reliability Corporation, or NERC, which have flagged that there could be issues in the Midwest on hot summer days and problems meeting demand. And so those data centers are not necessarily helping with that. And so this is a big and ongoing discussion that is happening not only in Wisconsin, but sort of throughout, where we are seeing increasingly that utilities are asking data centers to enter into contracts where they are not able to consume power on some days. I mean, or they can be asked to reduce their power consumption on some days. This is called demand response. And we are seeing also certain states move towards requiring that data centers have this capability of sort of essentially disconnecting from the grids and shutting down possibly on very warm days and when electricity is scarce. And so we could expect that there would be additional strain on the grid, primarily because just the data centers consume so much power. And it's really, really important how those data centers are going to behave on those days where we have a lot of electricity consumption already. Because if we can get the data centers to consume less when demand is at its peak, then we can also get away with building fewer new power plants and fewer less new infrastructure.
Lena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Lena Rold is a professor of engineering at UW-Madison. She was with us today to explain the energy demands created by data center projects in Wisconsin. Earlier, we heard from Carthage College computer science professor Rick Bingen about what data centers actually do and how they function.
Coming up, a new documentary shares the story of some of the Green Bay Packers' biggest fans in Japan, and how deep is their love?
It's immense. It's as vast as the Pacific Ocean. These people love the Packers, and I think the love is still growing.
The filmmakers behind No Packers, No Life, that's next on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about finding home within yourself.
How do you travel halfway around the world and still feel connected to home? For WPR's Karina Abrego-Cook of Green Bay, she listened to the sound of her own voice and the voice of someone she loves. She shares her story as part of the Home Is Here project, which amplifies the voices of the growing number of Black, Asian, Native American, and Hispanic residents who call northeastern Wisconsin home.
Two things about me that you need to know for this story. I've always been loud and proud about my family's background and where I come from. Also, I'm an Anglophile, meaning I'm obsessed with British culture. It started with my love of Tears for Fears when I was 3, and then the Beatles in my teen years. Growing up, I was always forthcoming about my heritage. My family moved from Kenosha to Green Bay in 1987, and there weren't many people who looked anything like me in Northeast Wisconsin. So people often flat out asked me, "What are you?" I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I'd joke that I'm diverse within myself, or I'd make a new term calling myself Hispasian, or triracial. I remember one time when I was 12, I was talking about our family background, and my dad said, "Yeah, but if you travel outside the country, you aren't gonna say that. You're gonna tell them you're American." That stuck with me my entire life. I had to wait another 12 years to leave the country to see how an exchange with someone from outside the country might go. My friend Sean asked me if I wanted to join him in London for his spring break. It was the trip of a lifetime. While there, we dined with a group of Romanian college students. My family background eventually came up in conversation, and their jaws dropped. They had never met someone with such a diverse background. In a way, it was a new experience for me too, because as Americans, we're used to people having ancestors from more than one country. My trip to London not only got me thinking about my triracial identity, but also my Wisconsin accent. You know the accent with its long vowels. Now, something strange happened in my short time in London. As the week progressed, my friend and I noticed my accent changing. One morning at a coffee shop, I ordered an Americano and I didn't recognize the voice that came out of my mouth. I didn't sound like my Wisconsin self. In fact, I sounded a little British. I was in London for less than a week and I was taking on bits of their accent. I was not totally surprised though. I've always been able to imitate or mimic others easily, though this time it was subconscious mimicking. Was it because I wanted to be British? Not for the food, but you know, the music and the culture, of course. Later that week, we went to the loudest Irish pub on St. Patrick's Day, and I struck up a conversation with a guy from Australia. I'm not sure how he could hear it, but he said I sounded like I was from Canada. And I laughed and I told him that I was from not far from there. So my Wisconsin accent wasn't completely gone. The next day was the moment I was really looking forward to during the whole trip. It was the visit to Abbey Road Studios. After doing all the touristy Beatle things and posing for photos, I couldn't wait to tell my dad about my adventure. After all, he bought me my first Beatles CD, Rubber Soul. Incidentally, it was the first Beatles album he had. I found one of those iconic red British phone booths to call my musician dad, who always fostered my love of music. After he answered, I told him how I walked across Abbey Road barefoot like Paul McCartney and peeped through the studio's iron gates. And it was at that moment, my friend said, that my Northeast Wisconsin accent came back completely. It's because I was talking to Dad in Green Bay. Wherever my dad is, that's home. My name is Karina. I'm half Mexican, a quarter Japanese, an eighth Irish, and an eighth Norwegian. I call Green Bay home, and you can hear it in my Wisconsin-accented voice.
Karina Abrego-Cook is an outreach specialist with Wisconsin Public Radio. And her story is part of the Home is Here project from the New News Lab, a local news collaboration in northeastern Wisconsin made up of six media organizations, including WPR and the Green Bay Press-Gazette. More information can be found at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is WPR News.
A new documentary follows a group of Japanese Packers superfans as they make a trek across the world to see the green and gold in action at Lambeau Field. Here's what their enthusiasm sounds like.
Go Pack, go!
Go Pack, go!
I love Packers.
Packers number one.
I love Packers.
Yeah!
18!
The film shows how an NFL team thousands of miles away across more than a dozen time zones won the hearts of people in Japan.
The fan group is called Japanese Packers Cheering Team. They made the trip from Tokyo to Titletown in 2017 after a chance run-in with Wisconsin native Ty Morse.
And Ty Morse joins us now. He is a film producer and subject of the new documentary No Packers, No Life. It's showing on October 15th at Marcus Cinemas in Waukesha, and the film's director, Craig Benzine, is here as well. Welcome to you both.
Thanks for having us. Excited to be here.
Yes, thank you so much.
Ty, let's start with you. Can you put into words how much love there is for the Packers in Japan?
That's hard to do. It took us 7 years to even fit it into a documentary. it's immense. It's as vast as the Pacific Ocean. These people love the Packers. So I think the love is still growing. It's just, you know, there's such a deep passion, and culturally, they hold so much in all the time in their society. So it's just a massive outpouring of passion that, you know, comes in a very unique way. It's very unique because of the culture, how much it comes flowing out at one time.
Why do you think the spirit is so infectious and just so that really translates to people in Japan?
Well, I think there's a couple reasons. I think one, you know, the the Green Bay Packers are a special team. So that creates a special allegiance because they're the team of the people. They're owned by the people. And that's very, very unique. And I think the Japanese have seen this uniqueness and they love that concept. But also, you know, the people of Wisconsin are very passionate and loving. And, you know, they saw on TV, watching TV from Japan, wow, this team's owned by the people. These people just have their own passion that's infectious in Wisconsin. And that translated to, you know, an opening for these people in Japan to, you know, build this desire to become a part of something like that. Mm-hmm. And through their connection with the team and the people, they started just letting their passion fly.
And Craig, you went to Japan and met members of the Japanese Packers cheering team. What surprised you most about meeting these Packers super fans in person?
Well, I mean, obviously the level of excitement they have about the Packers was surprising. The fact that we met at a viewing party, that they have viewing parties of previous games, and the party felt at once like more intense and more... They were more excited than most parties I would go to here around a game in Wisconsin. But also the fact that it was a pre-recorded game. It was a game that they had already seen.
They knew the outcome.
they knew the outcome, but they reacted as if they didn't. And they were wearing, like, there were Packer shoes. There was one of them had a Packer phone and Packer artwork all over his phone. Cheese charm on one of their glasses.
Yes, yes. Ty, you mentioned this emphasis on culture in the film, and several members of the Japanese cheering team said that Packers fandom is really a way to express affection and spend time together. And I want to take a listen to this husband and wife in the doc who really bonded over the Packers.
We went to the American football game in Japan as a first date.
Oh,
really?
Really?
Yeah. Wow. It's the first date.
And you didn't know football at the time?
No, not at all. I didn't know the rule. Yeah. But he taught me very kindly. And he explained a lot.
Ty, how do the Packers bind people together and in relationships? What can you tell us about this couple?
Well, the couple's absolutely amazing. And I think, you know, everybody in a relationship has a story of how they come together. And I think that their story focusing around Packer football is beautiful. And I don't think that, you know, obviously this can happen around anything. But there again, there's something unique and special about the Packers being, you know, this super small market team in the middle of America, owned by the people. I think it's you know, charming was something, a word that they would use, our best translation, charming. And that, you know, things like that that are charming, you know, they tend to bleed into our lives in wonderful ways. And so it's not, I'm not surprised that, you know, something like this magical moment for these people meeting could happen around a magical team that has a magical story with, you know, a magical fan base.
We're talking about this documentary following Packers superfans as they travel to Green Bay. Craig Benzine is director of the documentary No Packers, No Life. Ty Morse is here, a film producer and a subject of the film. So, Ty, in 2017, you invite 24 Japanese Packer fans to come to visit Green Bay, attend a game at Lambeau. When did it feel real that you are going to be able to pull this off, that it was really happening?
To be honest, it did not feel real until they arrived at Austin Straubel Airport in Green Bay. It was, the entire experience was so surreal. Pulling it together was so surreal. Even the communication, I mean, the Japanese are so detailed. They're so organized. They want to know exactly what's going on. You know, there were so many moments where they're like, why is this all happening? And you know, is, you know, are we going to land and actually be able to attend this game? And will we actually have places to stay? So when they finally arrived and then they saw, wow, everything was, you know, taken care of, that was literally the first moment for me that, wow, this is all happening.
One of my favorite parts of the film is them experiencing life in Green Bay, the farmer's market, and then the Zippin' Pippin' wooden roller coaster. Can you talk about the other things they did during their time here and how you shot that?
Yeah, I mean, we did so much. And so, I mean, you see in the film, I mean, we had a house party, Wisconsin style, shot ski and all, right? There was a
more than one house party. Let's be honest, more than one.
Yeah, more than one house party. We had bonfire outside. It's fall. I mean, that's what we do in Wisconsin. You get around a bonfire and you drink some beer. You know, one of the judges in Green Bay actually had a Super Bowl ring, and we had a connection to him. And so we brought them to the courthouse and they got to see his Super Bowl ring. But they also got to, they were staying at homes. So they were staying with, you know, my childhood friends, the Grant family and the Demerit family. They were staying in these homes. So not only did we have these experiences that we were bringing them around to, but they were invited into the home, which is not normal in Japan. You don't go to people's homes often. It's a very, very occasional experience. The homes are small, you know, home life is very private. So I think that homestay component of hanging out at these homes, having meals with people, having a beer sitting across the table in somebody's, you know, kitchen or living room, that was a huge part of, you know, the bonding experience as well.
What will it feel like for you to see it on the big screen, Craig, and see all this work culminate?
Oh my gosh. I'm on the one hand, I'm nervous. And on the other hand, I'm very excited to finally, you know, show it to just a general audience. It's something I've been sitting on, for many years now, kind of slowly piecing together. It's sort of like I've been holding my breath for like 7 years and now I can finally breathe. That's how it feels.
Well, Ty and Craig, thank you for the documentary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
And that is Ty Morse of Cedarburg, a film producer and subject of the documentary No Packers, No Life. And Craig Benzine of Madison is the film's director. The documentary will premiere 1 week from today on October 15th at Marcus Majestic Cinema in Waukesha. Have you met a Packers superfan in another country? How did you recognize your common bond over the pack? Were you both wearing jerseys? Talk about sports fans across the miles. Email Wisconsin Today at WPR.org. That's Wisconsin Today at WPR.org.
Coming up next week, we'll talk about learning a second language and why some language programs at the college level face funding cuts and are starting to close.
What is the value of a second language? Do you speak more than one language? How did you learn it? Or are you learning one now, and how is it going?
Share your thoughts and stories about what it means to switch into a different language and the role it has in our communities now. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org, or you can call or text at 888-642-0232. That's 888-642-0232. Leave a message in both languages if you want.
Wisconsin Today producers include Royce Padeswa, Lauren Cox, and Trevor Hook.
Our technical director is Sarah Hopeful. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for listening to WPR News.